the next chapter.
I'm not going to be a person that's going to tell you I ever saw a ghost, okay? So don't take me the wrong way.
I can't tell you how many times I've cried over trying to make cinnamon rolls perfectly on Christmas morning.
As long as I've got a book in my bag, I'm Grant.
The next chapter.
On CBC Radio 1.
And Sirius XM.
I grew up on scary Caribbean stories. Children with backward feet leading you into the bush to leave you there. Balls of fire flying across the sky to come suck your blood. But you know what? We never told them at Christmas. J.J. Lee might change my mind about this. Every year, he writes a scary story, and he reads it on the radio to mark the holiday season. He's all for mashing up creepy and Christmas. J.J.'s a writer and a broadcaster, and he joins me in a half an hour. But first, Cookbook Confidential. Two foodies on what's new and what's old in cookbooks. I'm Antonio Michael Downing. This is the next chapter. The absolute best part of the holidays is definitely the family, the friends, and the food. It's the time of year where we break out favorite old recipes or maybe try new ones. And if you got some cookbooks on your gift list, my next two guests can help with that. They're both foodies who know and love cookbooks. Aparita Bhandari is an arts reporter who loves to cook, especially desserts. And Lindsay Cameron Wilson is here as well. She's a writer and a photographer whose work revolves around food. Sounds nice. Lindsay is in Halifax and Aparita is in Toronto. Hello to you both. Welcome to the next chapter.
Hello.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Hi. So Lindsay, you're the rookie on the program, so we'll let you go first. You kind of have a dream job. How did you end up with food as both your love and your work?
Wow. I always knew that I wanted to work in food, but not necessarily as a chef, because I was I worked in a bar during my undergrad here in Halifax. And I just, after that, I just knew I didn't want to work at night anymore. And sometimes knowing what you don't want to do is the most helpful thing.
Hey.
So I went on to cooking school and then journalism school and just followed the writing food media path, which was kind of an odd choice at that time, but now kind of mainstream.
Wow, interesting. So very diverse array of disciplines coalesced.
Yeah.
And Aparita, what about you? Do you have a similar path to being the food guru?
My path is my mom. Basically, she had, when my sister and I were quite young, she was just like, you need to know how to cook in order to be able to feed yourself. And I would say it was a fairly like sort of a feminist agenda in the sense that her idea was that you need to be able to look after yourself no matter what happens. And then also I had foodies in my family, so they would always have, you know, be on the lookout for, this is the perfect, and I was in growing up in Delhi at that time, so this is the perfect place for samosas over here, or that's the, we always get jalebis from that particular store or whatever. So that sense of appreciation of flavors and textures was pretty early. And then when I moved to Toronto, you know, missing food all the time and or discovering food all the time, so yeah, just sort of led me to think about food a lot, eventually start writing about food, and then, yeah, just dreaming about food all the time. You gotta eat.
I wonder for both of you, like, when food is your work, do you actually cook? Do you do a lot of cooking these days?
I would say that food is the prompt for the work. So staying inspired and looking for the beauty and in the ingredients and markets and traveling and then hosting, that's where the stories come from.
Right.
And it doesn't happen when you're alone typically cooking. It's when people enter in and like bring more story. And then there's something to write about.
Well, so picking up on that, you have written and photographed cookbooks in your work, Lindsay. What would you say makes a good one?
Wow. Well, back when I was writing cookbooks, the story wasn't the focus. It was more just sharing of recipe. And that was in the olden days. And now I would say most cookbooks are really writer driven and photographed, and there's stories at the forefront. And that's what people want. You know, I think a lot of people are looking online for recipes, but for cookbooks, they're looking to curl up, to read a story, to get to know someone, to be inspired. And they're not cracking them open as often, you know, on a Tuesday night, busy after work. It's more the calm moment that you're looking at your books.
You know, I read a lot of memoirs of immigrants, and it almost always, including my own, I was shocked about how much I wrote about food. And I'm not a foodie by any stretch, but it kind of shows you how the stories of who we are and the food, they're kind of wrapped up with each other, aren't they?
Absolutely. I think a lot of people, like, the word foodie kind of implies there's some sort of snobbery almost to it, which I don't think is fair, because we all eat and food is how we sort of describe ourselves.
Right.
You know, it says so much about, you know, how we were raised and what we did in our free time and how we fed ourselves and the ingredients that were available to us. It really, it's like helps with your like character sketch of who you are.
I love it. So with that said, Aparita, can we jump into your first cookbook on your list for us today?
Sure. If for people who've been listening to The Next Chapter regularly, they know that I've been here before singing the praises of Ottolenghi. So this time, Ottolenghi has come out with a book called Comfort, which is all about comfort cooking. He's brought a lot of, you know, inspirations from across the world. There's a lot of Asian, Middle Eastern, but also your regular sort of pastas and other type of foods in here with like, sometimes you'll zhuzh it up with some miso, which is interesting to me. This is something that really we're discovering in my home with my kids now becoming a bit more, their palates becoming a bit more adventurous, like taking our regular recipes and adding these, whether it's miso or whether it's gochujang or whether it's some of these other kind of spices that are not particular to, say, Indian cooking or other sorts of, you know, Western, I guess, cooking, and adding it and see what we can do. There's sort of this recipe for a roasted hispy cabbage with miso butter. First of all, I don't know what hispy cabbage is, but I'm like, anyway.
I was about to say, start with the technical terms.
But it's a cabbage. And, you know, like if I can get my kids to eat more cabbage, so any ways in which I can kind of make things more caramelized, more buttery, more whatever, I think they're in for it. So this is one recipe that was actually a good hit. And then any way I can get them to eat more root vegetables, so parsnips and zucchinis and all of this sort of stuff, this is a great cookbook, kind of an overview of different cuisines, but with that element of comfort added to it.
I love that. So, Lindsay, what's your first book?
I chose The Violet Bakery Cookbook by Claire Patak. She also has a new one that's just come out after that called Love is a Pink Cake. And she is a Californian living in London. And I love the way she really introduced me to the idea of baking in a seasonal way. You don't really think of cakes being maybe like seasonal in terms of you'd eat a fruitcake at Christmas, but she sort of rotates flavors through basic baking depending on what's happening in the UK. And I just love that idea. And when I think of holiday cookbooks, like, this is something that I keep going back to, this book, because there are two recipes in there that I just continually make. And one is candied orange peel. And if you want a fast track to nostalgia or comfort or Christmas at all, like, boil up some citrus and then, you know, your kitchen is just filled with this incredible aroma. So I make her her citrus peel at Christmas time. And then she also has a tea biscuit cinnamon roll that is made in muffin tins. And there's something she was just so practical. And I love, I like, my motto has always been use what you have. Don't go out and buy the special cabbage, maybe just the one you already have, you know, like, and she, and her thing is like, she didn't have room in her little bakery to proof her baking, which means that she didn't have room for like breads to rise.
Right.
So everything was her cinnamon rolls are a tea biscuit base. And I just thought, you know what, if you don't have room, just make a tea biscuit, simple one that doesn't have to rise overnight. And we always had cinnamon rolls growing up in the morning, like something cinnamony. And over the years, I also have kids. They're like late teens now, 20. And I can't tell you how many times I've cried over trying to make cinnamon rolls perfectly on Christmas morning and, you know, just all the pressure of nostalgia.
Oh.
So just, you know, doing something a little easier, being kind to yourself, but still capturing that feeling that you're trying to, the balm, the familiarity in an easier way is really important to me. So that's what made me think of Claire's book.
Right. Now, Aparita, do you feel that sometimes, the pressure to just nail it perfect?
Yeah, yeah, because I also like to host. So it's like, I will do this to myself every holiday season. Like every time Diwali comes around, I'm just like, I am not going to host a party this year. But of course, then in the end, I do.
So your second recommendation.
So this time I want to recommend something, this book called Salt Hank. So, you know, I'm that person who tries to occasionally keep up with Gen Z and will know that there are TikTokers who are also food people. And so I discovered this person, Henry Laporte, a while ago. And so this book called Salt Hank, A Five Napkin Situation. Initially, honestly, I got it for the laughs, right? Because he's actually really known for these ridiculous sandwiches that he makes. They are huge. Like, if you can put one of those things in your mouth, I'm like seriously impressed.
Salt Hank. Why do they call him that?
I don't. That's his handle. That's what he went with, Salt Hank. I guess he's not Salt Bay. Like, he's Salt Hank, like very all-American. I picked this up, and I was pleasantly surprised. There is not a thing that he will not fry. But there are a lot of lovely recipes over here. He's got kind of his mom's pasta recipe, which is, you know, my daughter thought was really easy. And we made it, and it was quite neat, like, you know, and decent weeknight type of a dinner. There are some, you know, coronary attack type things in here that I'm looking forward to try.
We're putting a warning on it, on the salt.
But
hang.
I have to say, there is this lamb burger recipe that I'm really, really keen on trying very soon. And I love it because, again, it sort of seems to take a shortcut of, you know, using harissa paste and mayonnaise is kind of like in within the meat to sort of give it that sort of amp up that flavor. Now, you can, of course, make your own harissa paste, but you can also get harissa paste at your grocery store now. So, so I'm really interested by this idea of a five napkin situation, especially since my kids will be thrilled.
So it means five napkins because it's so messy.
It's so messy. Yeah, it's all like dripping everywhere. So if you can think of the most, you know, sort of filled up, you know, burrito or whatever, like there's a bunch of different recipes over here.
So big up to the influencer, Lindsay, what is your second book? Is it an influencer?
No, I think that Nigel Slater would say, I don't think he would say he's an influencer, but we'd all like him to be. We want more Nigel Slater. So he has, he's a food writer from the UK. I lived there for some time, so that's why I think that I'm kind of leaning in that direction. But he has this book called The Christmas Chronicles. And this is not necessarily for someone who just focuses on Christmas. This is sort of a winter book. And the cover alone is golden birch trees. And I don't know, I was just listening to this podcast hosted by Beth Kempton, and it's called The Calm Christmas Podcast. And she sort of kicks it off by saying that we can find that feeling of calm just by looking at a book. You don't actually have to cook anything, you know? And this is what we're talking about here. He narrates the book. You can listen to it online as well. This is the book even if I have 5 minutes in a manic moment in December, it just calms me. right down. There's something about that book. And, you know, his recipes are comfort recipes as well, and cozy and sort of traditional. And I think he even talks about how to wrap a present. But I think about he has a hot apple drink in there that I make. I, to tell you the truth, I hardly even make anything from this book except for this drink.
But, okay.
You know, it's...
What is it about the drink?
Well, it's all about the coming in from the cold, that contrast that we have
right.
here in winter, and that feeling of like hospitality and warmth. And that's what, so when I think of that, I think of Nigel Slater, I think of that drink that he would make where you come in and you smell it and you taste it. And being served a drink is one of life's pleasures, I think. But also make it for yourself so you can... You know that feeling of like putting something on the stove and then it's already, it can sit there for a while and it's there for you later, and you just come and think like, thank you,
yeah.
self.
So we've got to go a little faster on your third book, but I want you guys to hear these third books you have to recommend. So Aparita, what is your third book?
So my third book is, again, continuing Lindsay's theme of, you know, books that I don't know if I'm necessarily cooking from, but I'm interested in Martha, just because it's Martha. It's literally Martha the Cookbook. And so she's kind of been part of our zeitgeist in the recent couple of years, I'd like to say. I mean, first of all, there was that cover of her looking like very fit and fab. But she's also like, you know, hanging out with Snoop all the time, which is always hilarious. But then also recently, there is this Netflix documentary that has come out, which has been making waves for different reasons, where you kind of get a sense of who she might be as a person, because I've always known her as this very gracious TV host, and then eventually who, you know, served some time in prison, you know, but it's kind of like that facade, right? But to sort of see her a little bit prickly, a little bit whatever. So anyway, her cookbook is full of different sort of recipes, right from, you know, like how to make the perfect egg to some staples, you know, that need sort of Christmas dinners that you could make, to like, you know, desserts that you would sort of expect from her magazine. So it's all of that, but there's also a lot of story and a lot of like her photos and stuff. So if you're interested in the phenomena, then maybe this is a cookbook for you.
So it's a bit of a retrospective then.
Yeah, a little bit of a memoirish sort of looking through her own life in a way.
Yeah, she's certainly been iconic for generations at this point. So
she's a complicated personality. I mean, you know, I'm not going to say that, you know, I love her every inch of her, but you know, she's somebody who in many ways made her own way and made her own path. And so on that front, I'm really curious about her as a person. And so if you want to have a few staples in your pantry, it's got a bunch of staples, you know, and then, like I said, it could be a fun gift book, let me say this way. I don't know if it's necessarily the book to be cooking from, but it has enough of a bit of that celebrity cachet and some classic recipes.
And Lindsay, your third book.
I was going to suggest, this is not a helpful book at all because I think it's long been out of print. It was published in 1975, Madame Benoit's La Nouvelle Encyclopédie de la Cuisine, and it is the size of a massive family Bible. but the reason why it comes to mind, she was probably the original influencer. She was like ran a cooking school in Montreal. Wrote cookbooks. I think she was on the radio. She was on television. But she also, I think she did some work with microwaves at one point. She did it all, early influencing. But my grandmother always made a tortilla on Christmas Eve. And it was just part of our family tradition. And so I was just sort of looking into Madame Benoit's version, which would have been made with rabbit, like tortilla au lièvre. And sure enough, they're all the same. And the one we make now, I think, comes from Craig Flynn. He's a Halifax chef, and his book is called Fresh and Local. But it's beef and pork and savory and cinnamon and cloves and all those aromas that that sort of warm you up on Christmas. And something about a tortiere, it doesn't have to be perfect. Like Martha's genius is she does teach you how to do something perfectly. But Madame Benoit, I think that she just sort of had this authority as well. But was more of a grandmother presence. Martha Stewart would have injected like beauty into our zeitgeist. Like she added so much. And I'm looking at this book and it's black and white and thorough and kind of a Quebecois Canadian joy of cooking, which is like our history and tradition. And, you know, I'm sure that we could zhuzh up that tortiere a little bit, but it is something that I'd always love to have on the table just to, as a reference to the past.
Right. Yeah, the very first French-Canadian cooking I ever had was a tortiere by my French teacher in grade 7, and I can remember it as if it was yesterday. So it's...
good or bad?
Oh, I thought it was amazing. It was like, you got to understand at this point, everything Canadian in food was fascinating. I thought apples were exotic fruit.
Yeah, that cold crunch that comes from the north.
Yeah, but thank you all so much. I feel like I've learned a lot about the connection with food and who we are. And how we comfort ourselves. And it's been such a beautiful conversation. So thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Aparita Bhandari is a journalist and food lover. Lindsay Cameron Wilson is a cookbook author and host of the Food Podcast. The cookbooks they talked about are on our website, cbc.ca/thenextchapter.
Hello, my name is Ashley Ghostkeeper. I'm a country artist based in Calgary, Alberta. My music influences, they really start with my family. I come from a big Métis family where country music was just like kind of part of us. And then moving into more of the mainstream artists that I look up to, I am a big fan of Miranda Lambert and Faith Hill, Martina McBride, like really those 90s influences, and big fan of George Strait. I just love the simplicity of the music and the way it makes me feel. So I'm actually reading my great uncle's book right now, Elmer Ghostkeeper. He's my grandpa's youngest brother. And this book is called Spirit Gifting and the Concept of Spiritual Exchange. And it's been very interesting reading this book to learn the perspective of my grandpa's younger brother versus my grandpa's experience, who is the older brother, and how it was living with the land. And this book really touches on living with the land and not off the land, and how all living beings and spirits, like, they're alive and they are equal. Also, from reading this book, I was able to learn that my great-grandparents actually, they sang gospel songs in Cree at the church. And I was actually able to record a gospel country song yesterday, and I spoke some Cree. So I was really thinking of my grandparents when I was recording that. And I wrote the song of my grandpa's experience. And now this book is, you know, learning the younger brother's experience.
You gotta draw that line. You gotta look out for yourself. Don't worry about no one else. You've always wanted to see the coast, get lost in those mountain roads. You've been here.
That was Ashley Ghostkeeper with Honey, Leave It.
I'm Amy Stewart, the co-author of Matt Sundin's memoir, Home and Away, and you're listening to the next chapter on CBC Radio 1.
It's fair to say, and everybody knows, that Christmas cheer comes on a spectrum. Not everybody wants to have a holly jolly Christmas. J.J. Lee has edited two books of essays that highlight those less than ho-ho-ho experiences. The first is called Better Next Year, and this season there's a sequel called Upon a Midnight Clear. When it comes to his own reading time in this time of year, J.J. prefers ghost stories. He joins me now from Vancouver to talk about some of his favorites for the season. Hey, J.J., welcome back.
Hey, Antonio Michael. How's it going?
It's going great today. It's a very busy one around here. So how did you first start reading ghost stories at Christmas of all times?
You know, it's a very Canadian story and a very CBC story when you really think about it. I don't think anyone can spend any time on the radio listening to CBC without bumping into Frederick Forsyth's The Shepherd, read by Alan Maitland. And it just made me want to delve more into the ghost story. Firstly, as a writer, I kind of wanted a piece of the action, if you know what I'm saying. And so I started generating Christmas ghost stories to be read on radio. And so every year at CBC Radio in British Columbia, in the last regional broadcast, for the last, I think, 12 years, I put on a reading of a fresh-baked Christmas ghost story.
Huh.
And so as part of that, I had to do my own research. I started collecting anthologies of ghost stories.
So why at this time of year? Why do ghost stories work so well at this time of year?
Well, it has to be with the shorter days and that sort of the settling into the season. I think it's the same impulse that makes me encourage people to meditate on past Christmases that don't go so well. It's the same vibe. It's that sort of the thinning of the wall between the now and the past and the living and the dead. Both the memoir and the ghost story grasp with the past and prior deeds and how they erupt into our present. I'm not going to be a person that's going to tell you I ever saw a ghost, okay? So don't take me the wrong way. But I think that wall thins out in our mind and that we begin to ruminate and think about things. And so we're haunted people. And so we want to sit by the fire. We want to have a drink, maybe, you know, a little coffee with a bit of whiskey in it. And you might open up a good old scary ghost story. And you kind of just revel in it. And even better is that tradition, the idea of gathering the family together, which I've done, to read a Christmas ghost story is actually a great pleasure. Yeah.
So tell us about the first book on your list today.
So let's talk about the fundamental book first, the one that came from my teen years. And it's Roald Dahl's Book of Ghost Stories. You know, he's best known for Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, but also there's a lot of controversy surrounding his literary legacy and who he was as a person and things that he said on the record about, you know, that it is anti-Semitic or racist. And somehow that fed into his ability to be also a terrific author of twisted short stories. But for sure, he really knew what a scary tale was. And so the backstory for Roald Dahl's Book of Ghost Stories, in 1958, he's commissioned to develop a TV show based on true classic literary ghost stories. He goes through 750 stories and pulls out 24 to turn into the basis of a single season of TV. But apparently the pilot episode is so sacrilegious that the networks all pass on it. And there's like, no, we're not doing this. We are not doing this series.
Okay.
And so 25 years later, it's 1983, and he finally is able to bring that research to bear, and he brings out 14 ghost stories under the covers of the Roald Dahl's Book of Ghost Stories. And it breaks the mold. There's no Charles Dickens in it. There's no Henry James. There's no Shirley Jackson. Instead, they were back catalog stories. There were stories by people, A.M. Burridge, E.F. Benson, L.P. Hartley. Have you heard of them?
No, unless you're no, in not the at field all. Of
right? Unless you're into the field of paranormal and weird fiction. They're barely known outside the genre, but they're actually giants in the field. And in this book, we're treated to haunted ship berths, haunted telephones, but there's nothing creepier in this book than haunted children. And that comes from a terrific tale called Harry by Rosemary Timperley. And it's about a five-year-old who makes an imaginary friend. I mean, I won't, you know, you never really can say too much about a ghost story because it gives away all the twists, but it's a terrific story. It's actually been adapted many times before for television, I'm sure of it. So if you love The Shepherd, if you're planning to listen to The Shepherd this year on As It Happens, you should be the person that picks up an anthology of ghost stories for sure.
I love it. And so what's next on your list?
So the thing is, a lot of anthologies that are out there, you can actually find in a thrift store, right? They're banged up, you know, they're kind of lovely that way, right? But if you really want to do like a beautiful gift for someone who you know would love a ghost story, Biblioasis. Every year since 2015, they've published a 3-pack of Christmas / holiday ghost stories. Each story is in their own little volume, like a chapbook, and they're all designed and illustrated or decorated by Seth. And he's best known for the indie comic books Palookaville and the graphic novel Clyde Fans. It's really special. He's a special, special illustrator. I just love his stuff. And so this year they have an edition. It's the three stories are Podolo by L.P. Hartley, Captain Dalgetty Returns by Lawrence Whistler. Never heard of him either.
Okay.
And then The Amethyst Cross by Mary Fitt. Never heard of her either. But I was delighted by The Amethyst Cross. It's about a classics scholar studying Roman coins in a small village. And then her overbearing aunt shows up and wants to stay in a cottage nearby. So the scholar intentionally rents a haunted cottage for her.
No. Yeah, that's cold.
Not nice. Not
that's
nice.
Cold. I love it.
It's super fun. So it's a great little collection. And I just want to say Mary Fitt was actually Kathleen Freeman. And what really makes this special and special about the curatorship around Biblioasis collection, Seth's Christmas Ghost Stories, is that Kathleen Freeman really was sensitive and measured in her treatment of class and gender. And it speaks to, you know, that sometimes we think, oh, you know, you read a classic ghost story and there are racialized or very negative portrayals of people in it. And you go, oh, well, that's the way they thought back then. You know, we have to excuse it. And then you read someone who's writing in 53, 54, and it's like super sensitive, super aware about addressing colonialist attitudes. And so I think that I just really want to applaud Biblioasis for bringing forward Mary Fitt as one of their collection. Because, the history of the British literary ghost story is super centered around colonialism, race theory, class. Obviously, there's tons of class going on. Like, there's the servant and then there's the served. And so I started digging around and I just was really, really trying hard to find an anthology that could rep, a different idea of the ghost story.
Now, speaking of which, your third book,
it's called Asian Ghosts Short Stories. It's published by Flame Tree Publishing, and I'm mentioning all these details, and distributed by Simon & Schuster because it's not easy to find. It's one of those reference telephone books. It's very omnibus scale. It was edited by Lee Murray, who's of Chinese heritage, and she does a really good work introducing us to like a number of Asian literary ghost stories. Some of them are written in English. Some of them are translated. It's a little funny because some of them are actually British people who just lived in places like India and Japan. right? So it's not, you know, it's not.
They
it's
quote not unquote 100%. Asian.
Yeah, that's right. But then they went to the business of commissioning new works. So we actually have Vancouver's Yilin Wang and Toronto's Lena Eng, who contributed stories to the collection. So this anthology, you know, has like recent stuff. It also has some real classic stuff by Pu Songling. That's from the Qing Dynasty. I got to say, though, as a collection, they're not scary. They're more like morality tales and literary interpretation of folk tales.
Oh.
There must be something, you know, in the literary culture or the idea of ghosts. I know that I detected that the ghost is more normalized in a lot of the stories. You know, no one's surprised that there are ghosts. You know, they're more like a nuisance or like a domestic problem. And there's also a sense of humor. There's one short story by S. Mukherjee, and it's titled The Boy Possessed. And it's written during the Raj period in India. And it's so perfect because it's about a young Indian boy being possessed by the spirit of a recently dead British general. And the British general, yeah, he wants to eat mutton and have someone clean off his tomb site. That's the whole thing. So the haunting happens until the tomb site is cleaned up a bit. And so
I think that's
a really funny way of handling colonialism. And, you know, and showing that occupation of the boy in a way that's just sort of withering, you know, and ridiculous.
Yeah.
Can I leave you with one other
I was
going to
ask
idea?
You, hit us with something short and sweet, man. Go ahead.
Okay. This is a one shot. It's not an anthology. It's a collection of horrific stories by Lindsay Wong, best known probably for The Woo-Woo. But this collection is Tell Me Pleasant Things About Immortality. It is macabre. It is kind of like Roald Dahl's early short fiction. She's presenting like Asian types that I really, like Chinese personalities that I really recognize as like people I know in my life. And it's about their experiences in North America and their alienation in China. And I think it's a terrific, horrific collection of stories. Tell Me Pleasant Things About Immortality by Lindsay Wong.
Love it so much. Hey, J.J. Lee is the editor of the anthology Upon a Midnight Clear, More Christmas Epiphanies. He spoke with me from Vancouver, and the books that he highlighted, they're on our website, cbc.ca/thenextchapter. Thanks, J.J.
Thanks, Antonio Michael.
Cozy reads aren't exactly a genre, are they? But we do recognize them when we see it. It's probably warm, there's probably some curling up, there's probably some hot chocolate, there's probably something in the hot chocolate. It reads like a warm hug. Cozy reads and the holidays go perfectly together. That's why we got our contributor, Myrian Unja, to speak with Lucy Mann, CBC Books producer, about Lucy's three recommendations for cozy reads.
Hi, Lucy. Welcome back.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. I can't wait to get into this.
Same.
So full disclosure, before we get started, you and I are friends from Canada Reads last year.
Indeed.
You are the producer of Canada Reads, and I was a panelist. I think I know a little bit about what you like to read. What draws you to these feel-good reads?
Yeah, so I will say just how much I loved our chats last year when we were selecting a book for Canada Reads. And I think you and I discovered we had a lot of reading styles in common. So
yeah, there's some overlap.
Absolutely. So I love that we're here together today doing this again.
Me too.
I've always had a soft spot for a feel-good rom-com. I've been drawn to feel-good books in other genres. Like I love feel-good coming-of-age or feel-good mystery or literary fiction, but it's the rom-coms that I'd say I have this most soft spot for. One of my favorite authors, Marianne Keyes, she once said, I think it was in an interview, that when someone was asking her why she always ends books on an optimistic note, and she was like, why not? You know, life, it's already so sharp and pointy. You know, why not give people a happy ending? And I completely agree. I think we all read for different reasons. And since I was a kid, reading for me has been about comfort. It's been about escape. And, you know, that feeling of like, it doesn't matter where I am, as long as I've got a book in my bag, I'm grand.
I love that. I comfort and I do appreciate a happy ending. I remember we joked last year that I was the happy ending queen of Canada Reads.
Yes.
And I think that there's definitely a place for that. And I think that Cozy Reads are just such a beautiful example of that. So let's start. What is the first book on your list?
Okay, so the first book on my list, it's a multi-faith holiday rom-com called Three Holidays and a Wedding, which was co-written by two Canadian authors, Uzma Jalaluddin and Marissa Stapley.
This sounds like it hits all the bases. We have holidays plus a wedding. What happens here?
The premise of this novel is that you've got these two young women, Mariam and Anna, who are flying to Toronto for the holidays. So they board this flight as strangers. Mariam, she's going to Toronto because her younger sister has decided to have this impromptu wedding. So Mariam and her family are flying to Toronto for the wedding. And then you've got Anna, who has this new boyfriend that she's going to Toronto to meet his family. So the two of them end up sitting next to each other, which Mariam is initially less than thrilled about. Mm-hmm. But the plane ends up hitting this like awful turbulence. The two women get really scared and they just decide to distract themselves from the fear by chatting to each other. And in doing so, they end up being much more confessional and open than I think either expects to be. And Anna's talking about she's got this new boyfriend, but she's not actually sure he loves her for who she is. And Mariam has experienced a recent heartbreak. And what she doesn't realize is that sitting behind her is this young man called Saif, who is her first ever crush. And he ends up hearing this confessional chat. So that's kind of where things start. And then the plane ends up having to make an emergency landing in this little town called Snow Falls, just outside of Ottawa. So suddenly you've got Mariam and her family. You've got Anna. They're all snowed in Snow Falls Inn, and trying to figure out what they're going to do next.
There is nothing like a near-death experience to really help you befriend a stranger and pour your heart out.
And you know what? I will say that although both Anna and Mariam kind of are navigating romance and romantic feelings during this novel, to me, what kind of stayed with me afterwards was the friendship that these two women have. Mm. You know, they find themselves on this plane together. They don't have a lot in common. Initially, they're not too sure about each other. But actually, as they go through this intense experience of being snowed in together, they really figure out who each other is. And that kind of supportive and kind friendship is just really lovely to read.
I love that. I mean, they cut through all the superficiality and they get right to the core of who each other is.
Yes.
And in winter towns, in holiday romances, as they end up in, winter towns in holiday romances are usually pretty idyllic, you know, like a snow globe, and you can just picture it. How does the town in Three Holidays and a Wedding measure up?
Okay, so it definitely measures up. So first of all, its name is Snow Falls. Mm-hmm. So just that gives an inkling to the kind of whimsical town
Absolutely.
It is.
Absolutely.
I will say also that there's something quite special about this town. And I think Mariam's the first one who notices this. So her and her family are observing Ramadan. And she's surprised to find out that Snow Falls has a few halal restaurants. And as she's discovering more about the town, she sees that they also have a kosher deli, an Afghan bakery, a Sri Lankan grocery store, a Lebanese restaurant, all independently owned. Oh. And she's going to herself, she's like, this town just seems, this seems different. And she felt very welcome there. And the townspeople were so kind. And she was speaking to one of them and saying, like, what's different about Snow Falls? And they said, you know, it's a town that's very popular with movie folks because it has that small town energy, but with like the food selection and diversity of a bigger city.
How do all these holidays and the different traditions mesh in Three Holidays and a Wedding?
The title of the novel is actually a nod to the fact that it's set in the year 2000. Mm-hmm. And this was something I hadn't realized, that Christmas, Eid, and Hanukkah all fell within days of each other in the year 2000. And that was the first time that had happened in over three decades.
Oh.
So this kind of tri-holiday season, apparently, gifts and toys were like sold in record numbers,
oh,
that you couldn't
wow.
buy baking supplies in the shelves. And the way the book kind of nods to this tri-holiday season is, as we mentioned, Mariam and her family are observing Ramadan. Anna, she celebrates Christmas, and she used to also celebrate Hanukkah with her stepmother, who she's currently estranged from and is kind of working through that relationship. And then her kind of love interest in the book, who is starring in the sequel of this famous, beloved holiday film, also celebrates Hanukkah. So it's kind of a way for the main characters all give a nod to these three different holidays. And then Mariam's sister's wedding.
This sounds like a very fun read.
It really is. It really is. And I couldn't, like, I don't think a better holiday book really exists than this one. It is the perfect book to read at this time of year.
So tell us what's next on your list of cozy reads.
Yeah. So next, I've got a mystery novella. It's called The Mistletoe Mystery, and it's by Nita Prose.
Okay. So obviously, very much a Christmas story. What happens here?
Okay, so in this novella, we're introduced to the character of Molly Gray, who is the head maid at the Regency Grand Hotel. So Molly lives with her boyfriend, Juan Manuel, who is the head of pastry at the same hotel. And Molly just, like, adores Christmas, and Juan adores Molly. So on the 1st of December, like, he declares it the month of Molly. He stocked Molly's beloved grandmother's beautiful old advent calendar with, like, thoughtful presents for her each day. And all is just going really well, you know, the holiday spirit. They're both just so cozy and happy. But then Molly just starts to notice some suspicious behavior from Juan. And she just starts to question everything.
Wow. Juan sounds like the perfect book boyfriend, but clearly things go awry.
Yes, we are not sure anymore.
So that sounds very enticing. But I really want to focus back on this character of Molly, the maid in Mistletoe Mystery. She is the protagonist of other Nita Prose books. Give us the broad strokes of this character.
Yeah, so Molly, she can often find herself struggling in social situations and slightly misreading the intentions of others. She loves cleaning. She loves proper etiquette. She's a real charming, endearing character that I'd say as the reader you're really rooting for. She was raised by her grandmother, who kind of helped her interpret the world by giving her these very simple rules to live by. And in this novella, it's been a few years now since Molly lost her grandmother, but she still kind of navigates her life through these sayings. I should actually say that I've actually come to these maid books through the novella. So I'd say most people who have read them probably started with the first, which is called The Maid. The second's called The Mystery Guest. And then this is the third. So I've come at it from a different angle.
Yeah.
But I will say that if anyone finds themselves in a similar position, you can absolutely do that. Like, this novel to me worked as a beautiful standalone novella.
So how much of a mystery unfolds in Mistletoe Mystery?
Okay, so I will say that this novella, to me, it leaned more as a romance than a mystery. There is a mystery, but I'd say the mystery is a bit more of like a mystery for Molly, not as much as a mystery for the reader. Mm-hmm. But you really feel for Molly as she tries to kind of navigate this personal mystery and unpack Juan's unusual behavior.
And the last book you want to talk about today is?
So it is a sapphic holiday rom-com called Kiss Her Once For Me by Allison Cochran.
So the kiss in the title tells me there's some romance going on here. Who gets cozy in this book?
Yeah, so it is indeed a romance. The lead character is a young woman called Ellie, and she's recently moved to Portland to work in an animation studio. Now, the book kind of jumps between two time frames, both in December. So we've got present day December, and then we jump back to this one day in December previous on Christmas Eve. So present day Ellie, she's working at a coffee shop and she's miserable. She was let go from her dream job at the animation studio. She is living in an awful apartment, but that has super high rent, and then she's about to be evicted. She can't keep up with her rent payments. And she's also having to support her mother, who regularly demands money from her, despite knowing she doesn't have any. And Ellie is kind of still reeling from this Christmas Eve a year earlier when she met a woman called Jack at a bookstore during a snowstorm. And she fell in love with her over this 24-hour period before being betrayed by Jack the next morning. So very last Christmas vibes. In present day, you've got Ellie. She's having a particularly rough day at the coffee shop, and the shop's landlord, Andrew, proposes a marriage of convenience to her. He's been given an inheritance, but he's not able to access it unless he gets married. And then Ellie really needs the money. So she decides to agree because he says he's going to give her $200,000 if she goes through with this. The only caveat is that she must join him at his family's cabin for Christmas that year. So she accepts. So now we're off to the cabin, and no one's more surprised than Ellie to find out that Andrew's younger sister, Jacqueline, is actually Jack from the bookstore Meet Cute a year earlier, who Ellie fell in love with and who broke Ellie's heart.
Wow. So Ellie has a tough situation, and then she receives a very attractive proposal. And the fake marriage or engagement trope is pretty popular in romance. So it's nice to see that here too. How is that handled?
Yes. You know, I think one of the things I loved about this book is that it mixes quite a few different romance tropes. So we've got the bookstore meet cute. Mm. We've got the holiday romance. We've got the second chance romance. Mm. And the big one, which is the fake engagement.
Yeah.
So when Ellie finds herself in this like beautiful country cabin, having to pretend to be in love and, you know, Andrew's fiance, I think one of the things that's quite special to watch is that she isn't prepared to fall in love with Andrew and Jack's family. Mm-hmm. So Andrew's mother and Jack's mother is lovely and just really like loves Christmas, is really trying to make the most of their family traditions. And then they also have these excellent grandmothers who I believe were both married to the same grandfather at different times.
Oh.
And they're just very well-written, fun characters. And Ellie's never really had a family. Mm-hmm. And so suddenly she finds herself in this family, and which makes it even harder for her to keep up this notion of lying to them. And of course, the person who it's most difficult to lie to is Jack, who she is still very much in love with. Yeah, it's just, you know what, this book, I really loved it. It's just Allison's writing is so sharp. It's funny. It's charming. And she writes these like really realistic, empathetic characters.
That sounds exciting. It sounds fun. All the tropes are there. Like, it's checking all the boxes. It sounds very cute.
It really is. It really is. I think it's an excellent holiday rom-com.
Well, it sounds like you have done your reading in advance of the holidays. Does this mean you won't be getting any more time to read over the actual holidays?
So as the Canada Reads producer, my holidays are usually busy reading the books being considered for next year's show. So that will definitely keep me busy with my reading. But this was special, actually, because it meant I got to get my holiday reading in advance. So it worked out perfectly.
Well, I have to say, you have inspired me to grab my faux fur throw, light my candle, cozy up on the couch. These sound just so perfect for the season. And I am so thankful that you brought these for us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
That was our contributor, Myrian Anja, with CBC Books producer Lucy Mann. Lucy's recommendations are on our website, cbc.ca/thenextchapter. That is all for today. Jacqueline Kirk is our senior producer with Lisa Matthews and Trevor Carter. Aaron Balser is the executive producer of CBC Books. Thanks this week to Emily Chiaversio and the CBC Books digital team. I'm Antonio Michael Downing. Thanks for listening.